Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Hi, I'm Burl Bearer. That's Mark Boyer, True Crime Uncensored, on outlawradiolive.com, nestled in our secret bunker, better late than ever. Is our guest on the phone, Gina. This is a famous woman. I even have her book, which she sent me for free, which is the best price possible.
Yes.
Well, Frazzled Brain is the name of the book by Gina Simmons Schneider. She's a PhD. And I won't say I know because I don't, but I have a theory that someone who becomes a psychologist to help people does so because they're screwed up.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think sometimes we become most passionate about those things we want to heal in ourselves.
So you started off, or at least you grew up where you were, but enough that we could say you grew up poor, at least financially.
Yep.
So
that's true.
How did you manage to get so educated?
Well, what happened was I really had a strong drive for learning, even though I dropped out of public high school to go to work and help support the family. And the work I did was odd jobs, like I had a house cleaning business, and I worked for telephone sales. I was one of those annoying. It's all robots doing it now. I just did any kind of job I could do and put bond in school. So that freed me up to work and have a lot of different jobs. So, and I was sort of entrepreneurial too. So I'd make my little business cards and I'd put them up everywhere and, get house cleaning jobs and, stuff like that. So I also ended up learning how to do astrology charts, which people paid me more for than they paid to clean their house. So right. I did some astrology charts for people. And then I just kept on going to school. And initially I wanted to be a singer-songwriter. So I wanted to go into show business.
Well, that's a sign of mental problems right there.
Isn't it? I mean, obviously, if you're looking for security and you come from poverty, why choose the entertainment industry?
Yeah, I guess it's like becoming a disc jockey.
Exactly. Well, yeah. I mean, well, one of the things that was really funny is when I got my first job at a nonprofit, they said, you know, we can only guarantee you have a job for 1 year. And I was like, a year? That's job security.
Compared to as usual.
I'll take it.
That's the thing, in broadcasting, the ads for employees say no flakes or floaters, please. A floater will not tell you they're a flake or a floater, and they'll apply for the job.
Well, who wants to admit that, right? Who wants to admit that they're a flake or a floater?
So
or a drummer in a band. So that's usually the drummer in the band.
Yes.
It's usually the flake or the floater.
Yeah, just ask Ringo. He'll tell you. So you wind up getting a PhD. You remind me a bit of my friend Catherine Ramsland, who also does a blog for Psychology Today. In fact, she interviewed me for a blog. Strange people I wish to avoid. No.
I thought it was more imaginary friends.
Imaginary friends. Is that one of her imaginary friends?
What's her last name?
Catherine Ramsland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'll have to check out her blog.
Yeah.
Isn't she the expert on violence and
crime and ghosts?
Yeah. The criminal mind.
Criminal mind, yeah. And psychic stuff. So being as I have both, I was interviewed for her blog and she's been on the show. Your book, Frazzled Brain, is an excellent book, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. And if you're a criminal or want to be a criminal, this book will be very helpful.
And relieving the stress of being a criminal.
Yeah, because there's a lot of stress in being a criminal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another career that doesn't have a lot of job security.
Well, the thing is you don't need a lot of education to be a criminal. And that's one reason why our prisons are so full, is these people have not learned how to do it.
Exactly. And some people are taught that. I know when I worked in residential treatment with criminal offenders, juvenile offenders, and a lot of them were raised by criminals, you know, raised in crime, and that's the only life they knew.
Yeah, my buddy Punch, we have a little game we play here on the show, is how long does it take for me to plug, make my father proud of me? Because his father was a gem heist mastermind, and he wanted his son to be like him. And they had the whole crime family. So he had what he wanted to do, but no, his dad wanted him to be a diamond thief. So you follow in your family's footsteps.
Hi, this is Mark over here in the corner.
That's Mark in the corner.
Why you chose to start your career with troubled teens, considering how difficult that is.
Well, I really identified with kids who had to struggle to make it on their own, and I felt like I understood that. I was able to kind of avoid all of the pitfalls of getting involved with gangs or getting involved in criminal enterprises, I think largely because I had an entrepreneurial mind and I really didn't like the idea of getting arrested.
Yeah, that's not fun.
That was never an attractive option. So I was always looking for pathways to make a living that were legitimate and also something I could be proud of. And so I saw that a lot of kids didn't have those options. It was also the work I could get, right? I always had to find jobs that I was qualified for. So when I was a student of psychology, they had these milieu therapy jobs where you work in a hospital or you work in a treatment program, and you get to see that there really are three-year-old schizophrenics. I mean, there are kids who are hallucinating and they're not on drugs, and they have real serious brain damage and mental problems. And then there are those who grow up in these environments where they would have been killed sometimes if they hadn't engaged in a criminal enterprise. You know, so I had a lot of sympathy for them, and I could connect. I could connect with them really fast. And I also worked for the probation department with juveniles, and I was an assistant deputy probation officer for a time. And a lot of those kids were gangs, you know, they were in gangs, and the gang was their family.
Right.
That was, you know, their parents were weak or not available or not paying attention or unable to really enforce any kind of structure in their lives. Some of these kids had 8-9 hours a day of idolized time where they just want sometimes, and they get together, they make their little pack, and they make their little rules, and now you have criminals in training.
Just a side question, just for our interest. Did you ever meet John Hill in the probation department?
No.
Okay, I just thought I'd ask, because he was a friend of ours, and he did that for a career, along with other things involving gambling.
Yes, involving gambling and show business.
But he was the editor of Gambling Times back in the day.
Oh.
So could you... can you explain for the listener what you mean by frazzle brain?
So frazzle, all the clinical work I've been doing with people for the last few years, where the key word I would hear out of all my current coaching, we were doing workplace violence debriefings. So we'd go into these workplaces after a homicide, and we'd try to help people recover. And we really got tired of that and wanted to go into prevention so that we weren't showing up after the bodies, you know, are pulled out. And we could maybe prevent some of that from happening. So we got into conflict management and conflict management coaching for managers in businesses. And so from there, we were doing all of this training on how to really manage difficult emotions, those strong emotions when they come over you and you feel out of control. And a lot of times that comes from a combination of anxiety or fear or internal conflict, anger, and this overall feeling of pressure. So people are feeling a time pressure, They're feeling relationship pressures. They're feeling financial pressures. And so we get this combination of anxiety, anger, and then external pressures. And I call that frazzle brain, because what happens in the brain is it really reduces our ability to focus, to concentrate. It narrows our perspective, and it reduces our ability to solve problems. So what I've done in frazzle brain is given people these coping skills so that their brain can clear and their own creative ability to problem solve is accessible again. And because it's usually always there, it's just frazzle brain is this static of the brain that keeps you from tuning into a clear channel.
Now, it seems to me, based on my peculiar situation, my life experiences.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're out of your frickin' skull.
It's like the best ways. Example that I've said on this program before is a true story of the fellow who had the delusion that he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm dead. You know, I've been dead for several years. And the doctor said to him, do dead people bleed? He said, of course not. Dead people don't bleed. He grabbed the guy's hand and poked his finger with a pin. And, of course, a drop of blood. And the guy looks at his hand and he goes, oh, my God, I was wrong. Dead people do bleed.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're married to a concept, you will do almost anything to protect that delusion. And
it's true. That's true.
I'm sure you've run into that. You're trying to counsel people, and they're so married to what they believe they know that they're resistant to unfrazzling themselves.
That's really true. It's interesting how the two words that get in the way of all learning are I know. And a lot of times people are more comforted with the idea of certainty than they are the idea of I might not know. I might not know. And so uncertainty is scary for a lot of people. So that's often why people would gravitate to a silverback gorilla leader who tells you what to think and feel and, you know, when the world's going to end and answers all your questions for you, and you have that sense of certainty. And that can show up in delusions. It can show up with corrupt leaders that have followers that... remember the Amazing Randy? Remember him?
He was fabulous.
Wasn't he amazing? And you know, he did that whole stunt. He was this magician, and he debunked a lot of these charlatan faith healers and so forth. And he had a running bet that he'd pay $1 million to anybody that could do a paranormal thing under laboratory conditions, and nobody took him up on it. But he set up this whole guru thing where he trained one of his proteges to sort of speak in this really interesting, eccentric manner and wear a white robe and talk in these, you know, very kind and loving ways, you know. And he developed these followers, and they believed he could heal them. And this went on for a time, and then finally the Amazing Randy and this actor that he had recruited ended up saying, look, this is all made up. We just made all this up. None of this is real. And a good percentage of the people continue to say, but no, there's something special about him. No, he really has magical powers. You know, he really is, you know, this spiritual guru. And they would not believe it. They would not believe that they had been duped.
It reminds me of Peter Popoff, the evangelist who would bring people on stage and heal them.
Right. Yeah, and there's a lot of those kind of folks, and a lot of them can benefit from the placebo effect. You know, the placebo effect is pretty powerful. About 30% of people get better when they believe that this thing is going to make them better, whatever it is. So, you know, if you have you know, you can have pretty good odds of making people feel better, you know, just by getting them to believe you can. But of course, that is so dangerous and so toxic to society and to those people who don't get the proper treatment.
In your book, you talk about community being a useful tool to help people cope.
Exactly.
How do you get involved in a community without getting lost?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. I think it really helps to cultivate a healthy skepticism. And one of the things, the writers that I really respect, who is a leader in the threat assessment community, is, you know, Gavin De Becker. I'm sure you both know of him. But he wrote The Gift of Fear about how to pay attention to your instincts, and that our instincts often tell us when something's off and doesn't quite make sense, or someone's kind of bad, you know?
Yeah.
And, but we override those instincts sometimes because we want to be polite, or we don't know how to respond to that feeling. So he writes a lot about really being able to pay attention to what your body is telling you about something. And a lot of times if something doesn't add up, we need to listen to that and have a red flag go off in our brain. And here's why, because a lot of these use contwitters, which is a hypnosis technique where you, and Trump does this, where he'll say one thing and then he'll say the opposite. Stand back and stand by. He'll say two things that are contradictory in the same sentence. And what that does is it numbs your prefrontal cortex. It numbs your rational ability to follow the thought, because the thought is confusing. And hypnotists use that to insert a suggestion. And so you'll see that a lot, where people will start to lose their cognitive ability to reason. And it might create sort of stirrings of anxiety in their body. Now, where people fail is when they look to the leader to make them feel better. So I think the way to stay connected is to have your own, you know, strong family and friendship network, so that you can talk out those feelings and then come back to your people, your community of whether it's family or friends, partner, and say, something feels off here, and I don't know why. And that can help you sort of check. The other thing is, I tell people, never put a human being on a pedestal. Never, ever, ever put a human being, another human being, on a pedestal. We can appreciate greatness of achievement, a Nobel Prize winner. But if you're a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, it doesn't mean you know a damn thing about psychology or literature, you know? Mm-hmm. So let's not put that person on a pedestal and say, okay, they know something about chemistry, but they don't know everything about everything. And that also doesn't even make them a good human being, as far as someone who treats their spouse with respect, or their children, you know, well, or, you know, they're great in this area and they deserve accolades for that. So I think I teach people to stop putting others on a pedestal. And I think the need to do that is really this childlike need to feel like somebody's in charge and I don't have to be. And that is really unhealthy, to make other people in charge of our own lives.
See if you agree with this. I've, for a very long time, held the sheep-wolf analogy of people. And there are lots of sheep and very few wolves running around. And the need to belong is so strong within our species that we abdicate to the wolf. And whatever the wolf wants, the sheep does. And individuals that are of this mentality don't have the fortitude to do the rational comparisons and thought that you're referring to.
Right, but the you're exactly right. I think that is what we see in society. It's like animal behavior, right? The silverback gorilla, you know, whips everybody in line and they follow. And we do know, and that explains a lot of the misinformation that's going around and so forth, but the current psychology research shows that we can teach people pre-bunking strategies, and that can help keep people from going down the slippery slope of just buying into some of these conspiracy theories or corrupt leadership. And so there is hope that when people learn strategies or how to spot some of these manipulative folks, these Machiavellians who are lying and cheating and manipulating and using others, that when you learn what that looks like, you can have an antidote to getting sucked into it. So I think you're right. The need to belong is really important. I've seen people go the opposite way, where they're so afraid to belong to anything, and they're so isolated. And it is very, very unhealthy to isolate yourself from community. That is one of the most damaging things you can do to yourself. So I think a way that you can belong to a community is not putting the community on a pedestal and retaining your ability to disagree and retaining your ability to question.
Well, part of the ability to question, perhaps, is that a well-informed electorate is imperative to any democracy. And I've always had kind of this feeling that the dumbing down of America was intentional. That if people are not well-informed, if they're misinformed...
That's how we got Joe Biden.
To see, there's an example right there. That's our producer. they'll fall for stuff. There's a guy here in L.A. whose name I don't know. Maybe you know the fellow. He decided to come up with that if you gave it any rational thought, you'd go, this is BS.
Oh, is for Israeli space lasers?
Yeah, Israeli space lasers. That's one of them. No, he came up with this. He got $10,000 for this story, which he made up. And he put a lot of work into this, but he got paid $10,000 by one of the news networks for this story that George Soros and Bill Gates together conspired and paid people to go to the World Trade Organization thing in Seattle and be protesters and cause a riot and all this. And then after he sold the story, he went on the news and told, this is not true. I made this up. And if you look at it rationally, the story falls apart. Even though it was on the news afterwards, he showed the check, here I got the $10,000 for the story I made up. To this day, on social media, people believe it. People quack about it. And we gave an example just so that we'll go on Matt's program, which is on After Hours. The story that ran for a week on Fox, What American News, and Newsmax, that American veterans were being kicked out of a hotel to put immigrants in there.
Oh, right. I remember that. Yeah. I remember reading about it.
And when I heard the story, I went, well, wait a second. Administration is in charge of this, and this other group is in charge of that. This does not rationally
doesn't make sense.
And it took about a week and a half before it came out. The story was totally false, but millions of people had heard this story repeatedly from three and they only said, gee, that wasn't a true story. They said it once after about a week and a half, but the damage was already done. I still hear people talk about it.
You would hope that that the reputable news dissemination groups would research it, would make a little effort.
We even get static on this show. We had someone talking about being a child trafficking, etc. And someone wrote into us and said, didn't you vet this person? That sounded pretty far-fetched. Well, no, the person's a little hard to validate some of the far-out things the guy was saying.
Well, we had somebody here. Was it Van Gogh's paintings?
Yeah, Van Gogh was
The Ripper, and these crime scenes are hidden in his
Oh my God!
You know, he's a painter.
Well, you know what's interesting is there's this bias. We have these natural biases. One of them is the secrecy heuristic, which is this belief that if something is secret and we learn about it from a secret source, that it's somehow more true than public information that's widely available. So a lot of times all it takes for somebody to believe something is, oh, I found this secret file, or I know this secret that nobody else knows, or, you know, the mainstream media is all off. It's only these secret sources that have the right data, not realizing that secret same bias, and maybe even more, because it's just information that's been stuck in a file. It's not necessarily been vetted. But it is true that the mainstream press, like the LA Times and New York Times and Boston Globe, all of those, they do have editorial boards, and they do put print retractions when they make a mistake, and they do have to get secondary sources. So it's usually public information is much more reliable often than the secret stuff, but we tend to think if it's secret, you know, if somebody's trying to hide it, it must be true.
Yeah, Burl, you have a career, I say with air quotes, as a true crime author.
Yes.
Well, one assumes if you have a career, you get paid for it.
Yes.
But when you submit the material after you've written it, it has to go through a vetting process.
Yes, yeah. We have fact checkers and editors, and if I say something about a case in a manuscript that I'm writing in a book, they will be on mics immediately with, what are the sources? What's the information coming from? You know, is this allegedly? And also, as a journalist, you do find yourself in a situation where if something is government policy, such as the Tet Offensive or whatever it was that got us into the Vietnam War.
Well, the Tet Offensive was... Mm-hmm. Way after
yeah. The thing with whatever was the attack on the ships that got us into the Vietnam War, journalists knew that wasn't a true story. But to print the truth would make you seem so unpatriotic, being as that this was coming from the government afterwards. Lyndon Johnson said, it could have been dolphins for all I know. This is what I was told by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and it was BS. Mm. But, and then on the other extreme of that is in the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case, which now has a whole new spin on it, Lindbergh himself was involved in that with a eugenics thing. That's another fascinating story.
Mm-hmm.
There was information put out by, was either the American Nazi Party or one of those extremely far right. It was quoting a conversation between Lindbergh and his father about this. However, in real life, Lindbergh's father had been dead 10 years before this conversation took place. Mm. But if you didn't know that, you would just assume this was real. And there is more misinformation now than ever.
Well, that leads to my next question.
That's hard, too, because then people don't believe anything except their biases, right? So I do think reading multiple sources is the best way to still get knowledge that you can make good, sound decisions from.
Well, what I do in fact-checking for my imaginary friend over here, I look for both sides of the coin. I want to listen to the detractors just as much as the attractors. and give me an opportunity to have a more rounded perspective on whatever we're talking about.
It's also interesting to read studies from other countries, which I find fascinating. There's one, for some reason, it's difficult to for journalists to quote from this study for some proprietary reasons, but I can speak about it. 85% of Americans get their news from television. And it's usually just like the half-hour show, where you know, it's six, you know, 6 o'clock news, whatever. And if you if that's your source of news, you perceive crime in America as being constantly on the rise, despite the fact that because we have a news cycle and a news structure that you are always being told about crime all the time. So your perception.
Well, and they also think, and there's such a blurring too between opinion and news. I think that people don't, but this is one of those things we can pre-bunk. We can teach people how to discriminate between a blog post, a legitimate news article, and an opinion piece. And so a lot of times there, with the 24-hour news cycle on TV, you get these talking heads and they're just expressing opinion. They're trying to just fill space and time. And then there'll be a news, you know, breaking news, and then they'll tell you something happened somewhere. And people don't know the difference. And also, I get people, you know, confusing blogs with news, you know, that an investigative reporter did not write this blog. It's some person that decided to put their name on something on the internet. You know, that's all it is.
The FBI, in fact, one of my blog posts is from the FBI. The FBI does not like talking heads on TV talking about crimes that haven't been solved because the criminal watches TV also. And they're listening to what people are, they're, you know, hypothesizing about who did it and, you know, all that stuff. And sometimes it's completely nonsense. It isn't even based on any evidence or fact and can actually screw up solving the crime. It may actually endanger people's lives because the serial killer or the murderer watches TV also. And it just...
Exactly. And then you also get the copycat effects, which is something that a lot of threat assessment people are very concerned about, is especially with, you know, teen violence, teen shootings, school shootings, you'll see them happen in clusters because of the copycat effect. So we really are, you know, trying to control how those things are reported so that these shooters don't become superstars. I don't see it as a pathway to immortality.
Well, there's an excellent book by Dan Zapansky, who does the True Murder podcast. I've been on his show, and despite the fact I never killed anybody personally.
you've killed two co-hosts.
Yeah, I did two cockroaches?
No, two co-hosts of the show.
No, two co-hosts of mine have
that's,
died.
That's why I wear a flak vest and have an armed guard protecting me.
Yeah, we're taking bets on which one of us goes next. I've had two co-hosts die on me. So Mark
is learning from experience.
Yeah, he's pretty worried about now. Yes. and Dan Zapansky's book, Shall We Dance? They're making a movie. This guy wanted to be known as the most sick and degenerative murderer in history, and that was his motive for committing this crime. Well, I mean, he chops the guy's head off. He has sex with the head. Disgusting stuff on purpose, so that'll be his claim to fame.
That's a
strange motive. I mean, you know, if I do this, I'll be famous. So, you know, they should have an immediate death penalty for anyone who does schools. Those people want police. If the police don't kill them...
How about pedophilia?
Yeah, most pedophiles don't do anything.
No, the question is, how about pedophilia?
What about it?
How about sex with children? Do you feel the same way?
Well, in favor of it.
Instant death penalty?
No.
Oh, I do. that tells you a lot about old Burl Bear.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the death penalty. although some people are greatly improved by death.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's the hypothetical, you know, is it better to have NLT if you can get rid of somebody who's so toxic to society? And then there's how it's actually are given the death penalty. So then do you want to put innocent people? The difference between idea and practice, right?
The other thing about, you mentioned pedophilia, as you probably know from your practice or study, shows that most pedophiles, and they're afraid to go get therapy or help because of the preconceived idea that all pedophiles actually do pedophilic activities.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a fear for people to go into treatment, sort of paraphilias, or they have these sort of behaviors that are not considered appropriate in society, sexualized especially, because there is so much sexual shame. And so sometimes people can develop these sexual deviancies that are tied into their own feelings of shame. And many of them were victims of sexual predators when they were children. And then some of them grew up with that in their own families. You see multi-generations of children molested by, I've worked with families where uncles have molested all of their nieces, and they were molested by their uncles, and their, you know, grandfather was
molested. It's a family tradition.
It's just basically, this is the family thing. And some of these families are, I've worked with people in the upper income echelons with really, really powerful child molesters who have positions of authority in the government, you know, and the whole family rallies to protect the family name, and they don't want any of this coming out. And so some poor kid has to make the sacrifices, you know, or multiple kids have to make the sacrifice for the whole family and live with the secret.
Yeah, the secrecy has always been a problem. If you have to keep it a secret, the chances of it being fixed or getting help diminishes rapidly. I get to plug another one of my books, Taste for Murder, where the woman, Angelina Rodriguez, was sexually molested by her grandfather from when she was a little tiny kid up until she was 18. And her sister said to me, you know, Grandpa stopped having sex with us about the time they usually stop. And I thought that was a fascinating statement. When is it they usually stop? So I had to look that up. And it was about 3 years, and then they go on to the next one. Because, you know, they hit like 13 or something, and they're not interested in them anymore. But Angelina, she was pregnant like four times by her grandfather by the time she graduated high school. She, as soon as she's 18, she marries, goes into the Air Force or something, and marries a really nice guy. And they have a couple of kids. She could not be satisfied being married to this really nice guy. She had to go down the side and have sex with sleazy jerks. Because what's the imprinting there, you know? She even winds up killing one of her own kids for the insurance money.
Oh, gosh.
Screwed up people.
Yeah, people get really screwed up. And
speaking of screwed up.
Yeah, you're so damaged. Yeah.
What kind of techniques or what do you provide in your book to help people with frazzled brain?
One of the best things is to give yourself permission to imagine calm. I think when we're under the influence of frazzled brain, we feel a pressure to go to do everything everywhere all at once, like the movie.
Yeah.
So we don't slow down, stop, pay attention to the present moment, and imagine ourselves in a calmer place to lower our nervous system arousal. So if you can lower your nervous system arousal, if you can learn techniques, you know, everybody says to me, I know I should breathe. I know I should do deep breathing, but they don't do it. Or, you know, I know I should maybe, like, you know, spend time in nature, but I don't do it, you know. Or I know I should maybe learn how to meditate, but I don't do it. Or even just taking a walk without any podcast in your ear.
Except this one, of course.
And just, yeah, of course, this one, True Crime, is a great one for relaxation. but, you know, learning how to lower our nervous system arousal is a superpower skill. And if you can practice some of these, I call them frazzle hacks in the book, where they're little strategies for calming your nervous system down. Because as soon as you can calm your nervous system down, you can get into clearer focus. And all of a sudden, ideas and problem solving and things will just sort of come up. You'll be able to access that part of your brain.
I wanted to get to this before we run out of time. But are you familiar with Bradshaw's Homecoming?
Yes, yes.
I also kind of equate that with Dianetics and the reactive mind.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the courage to recognize the, in air quotes, hardwired response to stimulus.
Or reaction to it, yeah.
Yes, your reaction to whatever it is. Bradshaw called them scripts, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And Hubbard called them the reactive mind. It's learning how to recognize and rewriting those scripts. So the response goes from a negative to a positive.
Yeah, one of the things that's new now about the new neuropsychology research in trauma, coming often from a trauma base, right? With their dysfunctional scripts, they're usually from some kind of psychological, emotional, physical trauma. So they can become dysfunctional patterns of thinking and behavior. So if you want to rewrite that, really what we find with trauma recovery is we need new experiences going forward. So the going back and saying, why am I like this, is usually not effective and maybe digs you in a deeper hole of suffering. So it's better to say, how can I lower my nervous system arousal right now? How can I cope better with the suffering I'm feeling? Moving forward in a different way, not just necessarily thinking positive, but thinking in a hopeful direction. So hopefulness is maybe if I don't know how to solve my problem or relax right now, I can learn. So what we find in the brain is that trauma does not heal from just positive thinking. Trauma does not heal from just thinking differently. You have to have new experiences. So if you've been traumatized by, let's say, violence in a bar, you're not going to heal from that unless you can feel relaxed again in a bar and have a new experience where you realize that was an outlier. I was attacked in a bar. There are safer bars. There are ways I can go into a bar and have a good time with my friends. I can heal from that and have these new layers in my brain of experience that teach me something different.
Yeah, Leary used to say that a good LSD trip can solve that.
But only temporarily.
The problem is we don't know who's going to go psychotic and who's going to have a good trip.
Yep. Well, after a few hundred of those, I figured that out.
Boy. The book is Frazzle Brain by Gina Simmons Schneider. If you feel life is overwhelming you, or if you're just having trouble getting through the day, this book is great. You'll really get some help out of it, smooth your life out, and make it easier for you.
I should read the rest of the book, but gee, I just don't know.
Well, you know, Burl, I've had a book on procrastination on my shelf for 30 years.
Oh, God. And people do sometimes take us seriously. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. If you see Kathy Scott, say hi to her for us. He's a good friend.
I will. Thank you, Burl. Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome. Okay.
We'll have you back again for more fun.
I would enjoy it. Take care.
Thanks again. Hey.